Welcome to Innovation at the Edge, a podcast dedicated to bold ideas that will build a more sustainable and resilient world. We interview global thought leaders and discuss what's new in innovation and share insights for both entrepreneurs and corporations to build more agile and resilient businesses. Tomorrow's low-carbon and all-electric world will be created by both disruptive entrepreneurs and large corporations, and this podcast provides advice to both on how to scale their ideas. In this episode, Emmanuel Lagerwijk, Chief Innovation Officer at Schneider Electric, interviews Mike Rosenberg, Professor of Strategic Management at IESE Business School and author of several books.
We have all done more or less 5 to 10 years of digital innovation in the last 4 months. I think the crisis has shown us that we can do amazing things.
Emmanuel and Mike discuss the difference between innovation and disruption, how decentralized decision-making helps companies stay resilient in turbulent times, whether companies will give up or double down on their corporate sustainability goals, and how to pivot your career to something more meaningful.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emmanuel Lagerwijk, and I'm pleased to have with us today Mike Rosenberg, a strategy professor at ESA Business School in Barcelona, and also the author of many books on geopolitics, sustainability, and working right now on a very exciting project around career management in turbulent times. I hope he will be able to share a bit of that new project with us today. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Emmanuel. Thanks for having me.
When you made the introduction of our keynote panel last year in Barcelona during our Innovation Summit in October, you started with a clarification on innovation versus disruption with a very clear definition of disruption. Can you refresh our memories on this?
Sure, Emmanuel. In my view, the word disruption is overused. You know, there are people saying everything is disruptive. And in fact, we only know if a technology is disruptive after it's already happened. The term was actually coined by Clay Christensen, a professor of Harvard who passed away last year. And his mentor, Joseph Bauer, and all this was 20 years ago, and they were looking at the disk drive industry at the time, and they were noticing that as new technologies came up and as new disk drives were lighter, cheaper, faster than the old version, many of the old companies which dominated the industry simply couldn't make the switch. By the time they decided this was important, it was too late, and the new companies had disrupted them and basically taken over the business. So disruption is when there's new technology which comes along and the companies which dominate that sector, or the incumbents, as Christensen called it, don't manage to get their head around it and new companies take their place. For example, one of the examples he puts in his first book, The Innovator's Dilemma, was electric cars. Are electric cars a disruptive technology? And I know that you folks at Schneider are following the evolution of electric cars very seriously and charging infrastructure and all this important stuff to help build the low-carbon economy. So we will know when electric cars dominate the market. If those cars are called Fords, Nissans, Toyotas, and Volkswagens, it would not have been a disruptive technology. If the companies I just mentioned don't really get their head wrapped around it, kind of just pay lip service to it and don't develop really exciting models, and we're all driving Teslas, GEs, and who knows, Schneider Electrics, which could be a brand of car, because you guys know a lot about electricity, then it would have been a disruptive technology. So radical technology, or what another couple of academics called competence-destroying technology, big companies can do crazy and amazing things if they get their head wrapped around it. So that's really the question, which is there's change going on in the world. There's new technology. Can the big companies learn to integrate that technology? Can they figure out a way to make it real and avoid disruption? So that's really the meaning of the word. And I think by using the word properly, it helps companies figure out what to do.
So if you're a large company, a large or small, actually, if you're an incumbent in your industry, what are the two or three basic steps you would recommend to innovate, to disrupt, or to avoid disruption, as you said?
Well, it depends. So if you are looking at another segment, another part of an industry where you think that the folks who are dominating that industry don't get it, you can try to disrupt them. We had the case of Lemonade, an insurance company which went public, I think the other day in the States. And they're trying to disrupt the insurance market, becoming a new kind of insurance company using different tools and different technology. How to avoid disruption is to stay ahead. How to avoid disruption is to be clear about what are the possible future scenarios. And I know you did a session with Ramirez, Professor Ramirez from Oxford, who's an amazing scenario planning guy in your last show. But if you understand the different scenarios and you understand the different technologies which may become important in your industry and embrace them and invest in them, then you have a chance to avoid disruption. Now, it's not easy to do, but that's a challenge.
Does the current crisis with COVID and the climate emergency and all the changes we are witnessing today in the world, does that change anything on how companies should innovate? Does that accelerate anything, or is it just same old?
No, come on. We have all done more or less 5 to 10 years of digital innovation in the last 4 months. The fact that you and I are doing this show the way we are, I'm in my house. I have a blackboard in my house so I can teach class at the ESA Business School. I mean, this is amazing. We have done so much so fast. And I think the world is, I think many managers are surprised and delighted at the speed that their companies have been able to do things, at the quality of some of the talents which have emerged as people do new things. So I think the crisis has shown us that we can do amazing things. The climate emergency, as you call it, I mean, clearly we have to do amazing things. If we're going to avoid some of the worst impacts of climate change, it's absolutely fundamental that we apply some of the creativity and stuff that we figured out, how to work from home, how to do all this stuff online. And we apply that to the biggest challenge facing mankind, which is the looming climate crisis. Now, in the meanwhile, the other thing that this crisis, I think, has shown us is that beyond climate change and CO2 levels, there's a much more real problem facing many people around the world, which is air and water pollution. And if you can't breathe the air and you can't drink the water, you know, regardless of what's going to happen to your grandchildren, this is still a problem. And I think one of the things that the crisis has shown us is if we stop contaminating the earth will bounce back. And all around the world, people have observed cleaner air, more birds, the view of the mountains. A former student of mine from the Punjab says that she's never seen the mountains from her home in her life. And all of a sudden, she can look up the sky and see the Himalayas. And I think what we're starting to see is kind of a groundswell of public opinion and corporate opinion saying, I think we need to go in this direction. That, I think, is going to kick off a huge flow of innovation through all kinds of different material science applications, energy applications, and consumer behavior.
In your book, Strategy and Geopolitics, you highlighted in some part of the book that having a decentralized decision-making system in a company could make you more resilient. So in that world of accelerated digital transformation, of accelerated changes for many companies and crisis and short-term crisis management, did you see that at play somewhere? Is that theory confirmed?
Absolutely. There's a number of things which you need to be resilient. One of them, the resilience guys call it polycentric governance systems. What that means in real life is different people in different places can take decisions. And the people who are closest to something should be the ones who can make the most decisions. Now, what's happened, by the way, over the last 20 years is many, many companies around the world have eliminated a key position in the organization, which used to be called country manager. And the country manager has kind of faded away and been replaced by these global matrix organizations with a global head of something, some business unit, and a global head of supply chain, and a global head of finance, and a global head of HR. And really, in the local level, there's very little governance. There may be the head of the plant or the head of the sales team. That's really not good enough. That's really not good enough. And it's only when you have people who are locally responsible and can manage how to do these very complicated matrix or structures and have people who are locally responsible, give them power to make decisions. It's about giving people the tools to solve problems where they are. Now, that's really hard to do in a global company when you're trying to make, you know, everything the same and manage for the lowest cost and build these enormously complicated global supply chains. So that it's a really tough balancing act, but that's how you become more resilient. And I think one thing the crisis has shown us is that we need to be more resilient.
Agree. And actually, I think we shared that with you a couple of months ago. The fact that at Schneider Electric, we have kept that role of country president and that very early, at the beginning of March, when we realized that was becoming a global crisis, we all decided to follow our local country president. They would be fully empowered to make the decisions locally for all the people on the territory, no matter the teams or the global teams that those people would belong to. And we followed their advice, and those people were really empowered. And I think, to your point, it was a factor of resiliency for us during those first months of the COVID crisis.
Now, in the context of innovation, what you also see in the history of innovation, especially corporate innovation, even and even military innovation, is the most interesting things often are created far, far away from head office. And it's local folks who are local managers or local executives who see an opportunity, who see something they can do. They may or may not explain it completely to head office. Sometimes they have to kind of work undercover to some degree until it works. And then I think what truly amazing organizations are able to do is first let those guys get on with it. And then when they do something which works, recognize that it works. And then in a very rapid way through you know, a whole bunch of different tools and techniques and basically trust, roll it out across the whole organization so that everybody adopts whatever the guys in Hong Kong or far, far away adopted. That's when you get amazing innovation, when you get local people solving problems for real customers. This, by the way, is what Clayton Christensen called the innovator's dilemma, because the reason big companies don't manage to make the transition isn't because they don't see the technology, and it's not because they can't do it. It's because their big customers don't want it. So, you know, the famous example of BlackBerry, you know, they went to their customers with smartphone technology, and the customers said, no, this isn't very good for email. Our people need email. We need the keyboard. So BlackBerry said, no, thank you. Even though they could have done it, by the time the smartphones had become, you know, the standard, the BlackBerries would get. So this is the point, which is to allow people to do cool stuff and then recognize them for that and then figure out how to roll it out or how to either make the mothership kind of get on with it or leave it outside the mothership and recognize that the mothership doesn't have to do that, and we can have innovation at the edge by letting new companies kind of take off and do their own thing.
Yeah, that's exactly the principle behind the Innovation at the Edge program at Schneider Electric, right? So understanding that not all the innovations and not all the breakthrough innovations are going to come from within, and that the mothership can help a lot, but we have a lot to learn, and then you're probably better off creating a separate body to do that.
Well, the mechanism which happens in a lot of big companies, especially service companies like yourselves, is your customers might get disrupted. And your big customers might get disrupted. The mainline organization will not want to do things which will upset your main customers. So they will want to do stuff. They'll say, no, we don't fund that project. You know, I'm going to get a phone call from the president of such and such, and they're going to be really angry. So if in fact, you know, someone's going to disrupt them, better that you guys disrupt them, or that you become the providers to someone else who's disrupting them. And maybe that has to happen far, far away from the mothership.
And actually, I will come back to the impact of the energy transition and the opportunity in the energy transition for Schneider Electric, where we exactly see that, where companies which are today customers may become suppliers tomorrow, or competitors, or our best allies to create and accelerate that energy transition. But we'll come back to that point. Still in the crisis management and how you guys at ESA Business School have reacted and how it impacted your business model and how you very, very quickly, in a matter of days, not only went all online, but created those live sessions with thought leaders and spreading the word and basically going extremely fast, probably faster than many other business schools across the world in that transition.
It's a story of innovation at the edge. I flew to New York City in order to do a program for a large American company, which was canceled. That company saw the tea leaves. They said, oh, this is getting serious. They had to fly people from all over the world. They said, better not. So I found myself in New York City with nothing to do, and a program which had been canceled, and one of my colleagues said, we should do something to talk to the participants of the program. And then the other one said, well, why don't we talk to all the participants? So we put together a live webcast using Patrick Lagadec's crisis management framework. And I came back to Barcelona, and by then the Alumni Association had decided to launch a series of webinars on the topic. And they asked me to be academic director of the series. And in the end, we've done 43 broadcasts live on LinkedIn, et cetera. And the school, and I think this is the right thing to do, made a decision early on, we're not going to try to monetize this, we're not going to try to get people to register or capture their emails or get them to sign up for a program or anything, that this is a global crisis. And the mission of the school is to help the planet get better. And if we're trying to help managers deal with the big issues of the world, you know, whether they're actually alumni, whether they'll someday be school, who cares? You know, we're trying to help people get through this. So we broadcast the thing whole live. 500,000 people have either watched the thing live or downloaded later. But again, it's innovation at the edge in the sense that it was just me and a couple of colleagues who made it up. And then the school who said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Now that series is ending, and we're doing the last broadcast actually this Thursday. And in September, we'll start something different, and probably we'll be asking people to register, et cetera, because, you know, we are an institution which needs to make some money. But during the emergency, I think we did the right thing, and I know a little bit about Schneider's policies during this emergency. And I think what it's really shown is good companies with organizations with values, with integrity, have done the right thing during the emergency. I think as people go forward in terms of who to work for, who to work with, et cetera, I think people will remember, you know, which companies were there and which organizations were doing the right thing.
Yeah, that's right. And congratulations again for this for those live stations. So I
recommend you were a guest in one of them. So that sounds
good. I was in one of them, but the other 42 were also interesting. There's even one with an NBA player and a lot of thought leaders and CEOs and people. So I recommend everyone to have a look at those sessions. They're on YouTube and they're on the LinkedIn ISA Business School site. So let's go to corporate sustainability and the climate emergency. So you were saying a few minutes ago that people have discovered, and this is probably this awareness, we were all a bit worried at the beginning of this crisis, because at the beginning of the year, climate emergency was at the center stage in Davos. Everybody was talking about that, and you could see the financial community finally turning on this and becoming serious about ESG investment and all this. And then early March, big COVID crisis starts, and at least I was concerned that this climate emergency, which was still pending and coming, was going to be forgotten. Where do you think we are now?
I don't think it's been forgotten. It depends on the company. It depends on the location. I mean, if you're running anything right now in Texas or Florida, which are dealing with a very, very, very severe outbreak of COVID-19, you know, you're focused on keeping your people safe. This is not the time to do other things. But I think as companies and as different places of the world are slowly coming out of this, and the current emergency, first the demand shock and then the supply shock and then the demand shock, start to ease, I don't think any of those issues have gone away. I don't think they've gone away in the board of directors level. I don't think they've gone away in the mind of the general public. So in the sustainability book, I talk about something called environmental sensibility, which is how much an organization has to worry about this. Is it the shareholders? Is it the employees? Is it the customers? Is it the regulator? And sure, some of those groups have taken their attention off the topic for a little while, but they'll be back. And I think you mentioned probably the most important thing which has changed the world today compared to 5 or 10 years ago, which is the financial community is paying a lot of attention. And it seems that the data is clear that a company which is perceived to be more environmentally sustainable has a slightly higher share price and has a slightly lower cost of capital. Now, 30 basis points might not seem like a lot of money, but it is. And if you can get a slightly better cost of capital and have a slightly better share price, you're going to do it. Once this financial community starts talking about it and the board of directors start talking about it, then we start to see change at a much broader pace. Now, what has happened over the last 10 years is most companies have understood that if you produce less garbage, if you don't contaminate, if you use less material, et cetera, you will save money. From an operational point of view, you know, that story is done. Now, the problem was we built the world at a moment in time when energy was free, environmental externalities didn't matter, and waste didn't have a cost. So a lot of the world has to be rebuilt to be more efficient. And that has a fixed cost, which then has to be amortized over time. So there's a financial question, which is how fast can I become cleaner and still amortize the stuff I've already built over the last 50 years? So that's a real question. And I think your company has a real role to play, which is to providing some of that infrastructure to make that possible, as do many, many other companies. The only thing is how fast to go. Cristiana Figueres was the lady, who was an amazing lady, who negotiated the Paris deal when she was at the UN. Her point is either the world collectively over the next 10 years will take this seriously and push the transition along quickly, and I think it is, or they won't. If they don't, the 2030s are going to be very, very, very severe weather events. It's only a question of, do we embrace it now, or do we wait for the weather to get really, really serious and embrace it the day after tomorrow? But in the time frame of business planning, which is 10 to 20 years, it's going to happen yes or yes. And I think that's a critical, important point. Again, in terms of finance, in terms of big companies, little companies, and innovation, where do you put this? Do you put this in the mothership or do you put it at the edge? And maybe at the edge isn't such a bad idea because we don't know exactly how fast all this is going to happen.
But it's going to happen, right? So, and it's going to be driven by positive incentives this time, right? So it's not a constraint to be ESG compliant. It's going to command a lower cost of capital and probably a higher share price.
And eventually in regulation. We'll see what happens. But my guess is at least in the countries of the world where people's voice matters in terms of how they're governed. And I don't want to say democracies because this also happens in other countries. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But people like having clean air and water. People worry about this stuff. And if people worry about it enough, the governments which represent them to whatever degree will enact legislation which will oblige companies to follow suit. Now, those companies which are ahead of the game, I think are going to be ahead of the game, both in terms of public relations, in terms of image, in terms of hiring the best and the brightest. You know, if you look at the tech companies, Google, Facebook, et cetera, they're all very, very far along on this. And I don't think it's because they're customers. I don't think we care whether our tech suppliers are more or less sustainable. It might be about the board and the financial community, but I think it's about the employees. You know, if you want to hire the best and brightest men and women in California in their late 20s and early 30s, you better be very sustainable. Otherwise, those young people are not going to come and work for you.
I agree. And I cannot agree more. Actually, we did a survey last year about asking people who had joined Schneider Electric in the previous year, why they had joined. And that was because of that, because of the mission, because of Schneider Electric trying to be part of the solution to curbing global warming from the energy side. Talking about energy, if you had to bet on how will all this will unfold in terms of innovation and, well, what would the world of energy look like, especially now that the oil price is somewhere between $25 and $40 a barrel? Is that going to accelerate the energy transition, or is it going to, on the contrary, to give more time to fossil fuels to stay there?
Well, I think the low price of oil is a result of many, many factors. One of them clearly is that the demand went down during the crisis, so there had to be dropped or something. But another one is that the externalities, the pollution, is starting to be felt. ExxonMobil for many years has built a $60 per ton carbon price in their long-term scenarios, thinking that eventually the world's going to have a tax on carbon. And that's something which I think has to happen sooner or later. But anyway, in terms of the energy mix, as you know better than I do, renewables are growing super fast. Even at these low oil prices, the renewables, both wind and solar, are competitive at grid scale. Now, why you would want to put that kind of technology into, you know, a classical grid is maybe silly anyway. But so we'll talk about decentralized power, which I know you guys are very, very far along with. Coal, I think, is basically not finished yet, but it's not going to be the energy source for many countries. They're using a lot in Germany and Australia and China, but I think the populations of those countries are going to try to say, please stop using it. Now, in some countries, in India, for example, it's a little bit complicated because they have coal and they don't have any money. While you take the existing plants, because again, we've already built them, and start building the new ones. Now, the other part of the story is it the right model to have this enormous power plant someplace, which then has this enormously complicated grid, which has power losses, you know, feeding the world? Or is it going to be much more of a decentralized set of microgrids, which I know you're working on, which feed each other? And every house, you know, so you plug your car into your house, you plug your house into your car, you've got the panels on the roof, you've got the battery pack in the garage, and your house is just an example of what a building could look like, what a neighborhood could look like, what an industrial park or an airport could look like, and eventually a town. This has to change, and it will change. Again, the question is, who's going to pay for it? How long is it going to take? And is it going to happen in the developed world first, and then the developing world? Is it going to be in power? These are questions which I don't think anybody really knows. And again, the best way to start to play with these things is to use scenarios. Say, well, what would happen if it looks like this? And what would happen if it looks like that? And this is what I think Professor Ramirez was talking about. And then working backwards to see, you know, what's good for my company, and how does my company get impacted if the world goes this way or that way? But change is necessary. My mom lives in Ukiah, California. You know, they turn her power off every couple of months because they're worried about forest fires. And you know the story very well, that power lines are in the forest, they are old, they are falling apart, and they can light fires. They lit the fire, what they call the campfire, which destroyed Paradise, California, killing almost 100 people and devastating, you know, a whole region of the country because the power grid's not safe anymore. So it has to be replaced with one thing or another. There is change coming. I don't think we know what all the shapes of it are. I think it's definitely not going to be coal. It's definitely going to be gas through the existing network. And eventually it's going to be distributed renewable power.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely, to your point, we don't exactly know how this will happen. There's space for innovation and for entrepreneurship. Precisely, if you're an entrepreneur these days and you just started your company in those times of COVID, there's this legend of best companies were started in times of crisis, right? So Microsoft and many other examples like this. What advice would you give to that entrepreneur, to that person that tries to innovate?
There are people who have, you know, a really cool idea about how to get something done. And that really cool idea could be the solution. And there are other people who have said, hey, there's a really clear problem. Some people are really dissatisfied with what's going on. And there's an opportunity to get them to be satisfied. They don't necessarily have the solution, but they know what the problem is. Yeah, these are kind of two different classes of folks. If you're the second class, you know, the idea is to make sure it's a real problem and then to look at multiple solutions for that problem. And then as the world evolves, you know, be ready to pivot back and forth between the right solutions. If you're the better mousetrap kind of guy, to say that idea that you've just got a really cool idea, I've got a better way of managing the information, which is from different power plants or from different panels, and I can optimize this with my really cool algorithm, then I think the issue is to make sure that you can find the right problems and maybe solve a problem you weren't planning to solve with your technology. Innovation is about being open-minded. Innovation is about seeing things and being ready to see things. So for the problem people, if you will, it's about being flexible in terms of which solutions to use to solve the problem which you've already identified. And for the solutions people, it's being flexible about understanding that there's lots of different problems in the world. Which ones can my cool thing help? And maybe that'll take you into a space, an industrial space, which you never imagined. You know, maybe you built it for energy management and find yourself doing hospital administration. One of my students, he's my age, but he's the CEO of a company which makes sportswear in Ireland, number one sportswear O'Neill's in Ireland. 2 days after the crisis hit Ireland and the government was locked down and sports again, you're always playing sports, his company was making scrubs for hospitals. And in fact, Ireland used to import most of their scrubs from China. But now they find that they can make Irish scrubs at the same price or better and a better quality. And they're really pretty scrubs. They're nice scrubs. They fit properly. And of course, because they're a sportswear company. So now they're in this whole new line of business, which is the hospital clothing business, which they weren't even in before. So this is the idea. He has fabric. He has designers. He has sewing machines. He's got all this stuff, you know, ready to go. The problem that he's solving, which is to give people sporting goods, goes away. But the country doesn't have enough hospital clothes. So he just switched to a completely business. He didn't know anything about it, but they're doing very, very well. So I think that's the idea is entrepreneurs need to be fast, but they need to be focused. They need to have a passion for what they're up to, whether it's a passion for the problem they're going to solve or a passion for the technology that they're building. It's got to be genuine. It's got to be authentic. And it's got to be, you know, kind of all in. Otherwise, they're not going to make it.
So talking about agility and bouncing back in times of crisis or rapid change, during this crisis, during the first 3 months, when everybody was grounded and working from home, I had a lot of friends, a lot of people in my network, even colleagues who reached out saying, hey, I think I want to change jobs. I think I want to do something else. I think it's time now for me to leave my job and create my company and write the second chapter or the third chapter of my career. So after writing a lot about geopolitics and strategy, climate change and strategy. Now you're working on this new project about second acts and how you manage your career. So can you tell us a bit about this?
Well, there's a couple of pieces to that story. One piece is most of the career advice that we've been given, most of our thinking about careers and managing your career is based on a world which no longer exists. And it doesn't exist in a whole lot of ways. Linda Grattan and her colleague at the London Business School published a book called The 100-Year Life. Because statistically, you know, my kids and your kids will live to 100. And if you live to 100, the idea that I'm going to go to school, learn how to do something, do it for 30 years, and then retire doesn't work anymore. Because if you retire at 65 and you live to 100, you got to make an awful lot of money to live, you know, for those 35 years or 45 years it's just hard to do. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm going to work till I'm 70 or something like that. Now, I'm a professor, so it's easy, but the point is, you know, the model just doesn't work, and the things are changing too quickly. we will never learn how to do something well enough to do it for 40 years, because in 40 years, the world's going to be a completely different place. And the differences are because of geopolitical differences, sustainability and environmental differences, digital differences. We are building a different world even as we speak. That whole thing takes you to a different understanding of what a career is and what people should be doing with their time. For example, I have two daughters in their 20s. Typically, if you talk to most people in their 20s, most of their family thinks that they're lost because they haven't yet picked their career. They haven't yet, you know, started their first job at Schneider Electric to become, you know, they're doing different things. They're traveling, they're teaching the languages, they're going surfing with their friends. They work for 2 years, they quit their job and they go do something else. And people think they're crazy. But in fact, if you're going to live to 100, what should you do in your 20s? You should figure out what it is that really gets you excited, what you're really passionate about. And the only way to figure that out is to try different things, to go live in different parts of the world and be involved in different industries. And as you figure that out, then in your 30s, you should probably, you know, get some significant traction on something. But being fully aware that you're going to have to go back to school, learn how to do something else, and have a second, third, or fourth act. And once we recognize that that's the plan, then a whole bunch of things change, which is, you know, how long to stay in a job, how long to stay in an industry. Even industry, I don't use the word industry anymore because it's kind of obsolete. You know, what industry are you guys? What space are you in? You're in the space of the energy transition. Okay, what the hell is that? We don't know what that means. But it's clearly not the electric power infrastructure industry anymore. It's something broader than that. Some people call it an ecosystem, but I think that's a little bit too techy for at least for my head. So I call it a space. It's a space. And then a friend of mine from the Rocky Mountain Institute, Hutch Hutchinson, he came to class one day and told my students that they should pick a problem that they want to help solve. There's enough problems in the world, from climate change to inequality to pandemics and health. Pick a problem that you want to be part of the solution to. Focus on that for 10, 20 years. And that could be one step of your career. Maybe at another point in your career, you pick a different problem. So the point is, if you can associate your career journey with something bigger, something about purpose, something about problems, and then keep an eye on how the spaces evolve and not lose track of the trends, I think it's possible to manage a much more interesting and a much more rewarding career, which lasts over time.
Well, that's inspiring, and looking forward to reading your work on this. Mike Rosenberg, strategy professor at ESA Business School, thanks for your time today. It was great to have you on the show, and see you very, very soon.
Thanks for listening to Innovation at the Edge by Schneider Electric. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you'll never miss an episode. If you like this episode, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Thanks. The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be undertaken as financial, economic, legal, business, tax, or investment advice. The information, statements, views, and opinions should not be construed as the provision of advice by Schneider Electric, or as an offer to buy or sell any products or services, or to make or consider an investment or course of action.